ever wonder if that family legend about a certain heirloom is really true? Well, maybe you need The History Detectives. The popular PBS series is now in its 9th season, investigating interesting historical objects and places to bring American history to life. This year, History Detectives airs on a new night on Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV. Today, we're joined by two of the history detectives, Tukufu Zuberi and Wes Cowan. Tukufu Zuberi is the Lazary Family Professor of Race Relations at the University of Pennsylvania. He also developed and expanded the Center for Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show, Tukufu.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
And returning to All Sides, Wes Cowan. He's founder and owner of Cowan's Auctions, Inc. in Cincinnati, Ohio, of course, and is a featured appraiser on the PBS series Antiques Roadshow. Welcome back to the show, Wes.
Great to be here.
To our listeners, this season, the series features some investigations connected to historical milestones, such as the 150th anniversary of the Civil War and also the 70th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Do you have an object of curiosity from one of those eras? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Wes, let's listen to this excerpt from the History Detectives episode in which you meet Terry Garber from McCall, Idaho. He collects Western memorabilia, and it's a show about investigating a saddle that he had that may have belonged to Hollywood's first stuntman.
So what attracted you about this saddle?
I bought it because of the name on the cantle.
So, Canut, and then there's a Y-A-K in the middle. Yak Canut? Who's Yak Canut?
Yakima was a world champion rodeoer. I heard he moved to Hollywood and did stunt work.
Wes, you'd never heard of Yakima Canut, or Yak Canut, when you started this investigation. He turned out to be a pretty interesting guy. He may have created the profession of the Hollywood stuntsman, and we've seen him in many famous movies and not just Westerns. What are some of those movies?
Well, anyone who's seen John Wayne in Stagecoach will remember Yak Canut, because Yak Canut, not only did he play some Indians attacking the stagecoach, but in the scene where John Wayne is seen climbing over the horses, the stampeding horses dragging the stagecoach behind them, and then stopping the horses, that was Yakima Canut. When you see Clark Gable driving a burning coach or burning carriage through Atlanta in Gone with the Wind, that's Yakima Canut. Many, many important 1920s and 30s Western movies that used stuntmen used Yak Canut to perform the stunts.
He wasn't just one of the first, but he also advocated for safer working conditions for stuntsmen and stuntswomen, I'm sure, eventually.
Well, that's right, and he perfected stunts that were safe and prevented injury. And I think for animal rights people, right, it's also important to remember that he also advocated that that Hollywood perform stunts safely for the animals too.
So, did you borrow the object? Was that the case with the saddle as well?
Yep, had to haul that saddle around all over the place. It was an interesting event.
You know, I know I've asked you this before, but when you ask to borrow things for the purpose of your investigation, are folks ever reluctant to part with their often beloved object?
No, that's a good question, and you know, Tukufu, I think, can jump in here too. My sense is that people trust us to take care of the things, I can guarantee you that we're insuring these while they're in our possession. But more so, they're genuinely interested in wanting to find out, and they say, well, sure, go on, take it with you, bring it back, just take care of it.
How about you, Tukufu?
You know, people, this is the beauty of this show. We love the people, and the people love us. They give us their invaluable objects. And I say invaluable because, you know, these things often mean much more than even how much people pay for them. Sometimes they're a family heirloom that, you know, has a value within itself for that family. But they give us these objects to take all over the country as we try to find answers for them. And we never promised them that we were going to give them a good answer, or we never promised we were going to give them their answer. We promised them we're going to do an investigation and give them the answer that we find. And they entrust us with the object and with the story that we're going to tell. So that's a beautiful thing. And as you know, as Wes says, we ensure it and we take care of it in all those ways, but we also attempt to add value by giving them the historical story surrounding their object.
You know, and Takufu has just mentioned something that I had really never thought of, and it's such a great point. Not only do they entrust us with the object, they entrust us with the story, because sometimes the stories aren't what they might necessarily want to hear. We're going to come back sometimes and say, you know what? That chair really wasn't used by George Washington at Valley Forge. And that can be kind of a downer. But nonetheless, the families trust us with telling the story. And that's a great point, Takufu.
Yeah, you know, I remember Wes and I were, we did a story together a few years ago in which it took us to a city, a kind of off the beaten track city in Louisiana. What city was that? Was that St. Martinville or something?
Yes,
like
St. Martinsville Parish, yes.
Yes, and there was these two wonderful women who had a great-grand-uncle who had received an award from Napoleon, and they wanted to know the story. They gave us the object. We did our investigation, and we came back with the information. Some of it was mixed. It wasn't a yes or no. It was a yes, their great-grand-uncle did receive a distinction from Napoleon, but that what they had presented to us wasn't what Napoleon would have given him. And so, you know, that was kind of mixed. They weren't too happy to hear that, if I recall.
Well, and not only that, in this case, it was a naval dirk that they had, which was a sort of a short sword that's used was used in the 19th century Navy, and the dirk was not of the Napoleonic period. But what we found out was that Napoleon had given their ancestor a set of pistols as an award for, I think he was holding the battle flag up, or when the battle flag fell, he picked it up and made sure that it didn't get captured. At any rate, what we discovered was that the pistols had been sold by the family years before, and this came out in our conversations with the two sisters. And of course, that was a big downer for the sisters that they had sold the pistols, thinking that they had nothing to do with Napoleon. And that the family tradition had always said it was the dirk or the sword.
My guests are Takufu Zuberi and also Wes Cowan. They're both history detectives on the popular PBS series. It's now in its 9th season. We'll post a link to that so you can learn more about it and what's coming up at WOSU.org/allsides. Returning to that saddle story, because I was very interested in the fact that this was such a turning point in history, and I find that a lot in your stories that you do, that there's a crux to them, and it was the crux of something in Hollywood, of all places. But you discovered, though, Wes, that even though that's the case about the character behind this, that the saddle itself was not necessarily used in a Hollywood film.
Oh, no. The saddle was actually even more, much more important than the Hollywood saddles that Yak Kanut used. This turned out to be the saddle that Yak Kanut won his first all-around rodeo championship on. I think it was in 1919 at the Pendleton Roundup. So it was historically, in the history of rodeos, an amazingly important saddle. But it was also one that he would have used in his everyday work.
And it explains why it was so worn and well used, and also a changed over time a lot.
That's exactly right.
You found out also not only about Hollywood, but about how bronc riding had changed over time.
Yeah, you know, the Pendleton Roundup, and for those of you, the listeners who've never been to Pendleton or heard about the Pendleton Roundup, it's one of the oldest rodeos in the country. It's held each fall, and it attracts thousands of people who come to this rodeo, and it's a major event on the Professional Rodeo Association circuit, I'm sure. But when it first started, bronc riders could use any type of saddle that they wanted, and certain saddles gave riders greater advantages than other saddles. So right after the Canut won the championship, the Professional Rodeo Association changed the configuration of saddles to sort of level the playing field, and we learned about that in the investigation too.
If you want to give us a call and tell us about an object that you're interested in, that you have, and want to maybe learn, I'm sure that Wes and Tukufu can't answer, tell you anything about it over the air, but maybe can give you some ideas about where to start your own search, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jerry from Columbus, you're on the air. Why don't you turn down your radio?
Down, Ms. Fisher. Okay. Thank you very much for taking the call, mm-hmm. and I couldn't believe it. But first of all, I'd like to be sure that everyone is aware that 622,000 young men were killed or died in the Civil War, 50% more than young Americans killed in World War II. But the item I want to mention, my brother, he's 86, I'm just a little younger, he has a 1857 Star revolver percussion cap. It didn't have, it's not a Colt, and it was carried by my great granduncle John, who rode with Custer's 7th Cavalry in the Civil War. And I don't know if your guests are familiar with the book Custer and His Wolverines.
I certainly know of Custer and his Michigan Pardon? Boys, so yeah, that's a familiar story.
Yeah, well, the story, and this may be a war story, but my great uncle Willie told me when I was a teenager that my uncle John lost this revolver in a cavalry charge jumping over a creek, but somebody found it and it got back to him somehow. But anyway, I played with it when I was a kid. I don't know if you you're probably familiar with these percussion cap six shooters. It wasn't a Colt. Are you familiar with the Star?
Oh, of course, sure. The Star was not nearly as popular as the Colt Army, the model 1860 Colt Army, but some states were issued these. I don't know if the Michigan 7th was issued the Stars or not, but it would be an easy thing to find out.
Thanks, Jerry, for that call. We're talking with Wes Cowan and Tukufu Zuberi of the History Detectives. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Coming up next hour on All Sides Weekend with your host Christopher Purdy today, Chris will be talking about the arts in Central Ohio, including Catco Phoenix Theater, the Columbus Symphony, and some barbershop harmonies, too. That starts at 11 o'clock this morning. In the weather forecast for Central Ohio, mostly sunny skies today with a high near 60, or rather 84 degrees. And then tonight, we'll have a low around 60. Tomorrow, we'll have a chance of showers, 20% chance of rain, and then a little more rain on Sunday, and finally some partly cloudy skies on Monday. Currently, we have 71 degrees in Central Ohio.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club presenting their weekly forum. Wednesday at noon, it's What the Frack? Shale Gas Implications for Energy and the Environment. Tickets and more information available at columbusmetroclub.org.
My guests are Wes Cowan and Tukufu Zuberi of the History Detectives. Is there something that you're wondering, a quest that you're on about an object you own? Maybe they could give you some ideas about where to go to look. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides at WOSU.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Tukufu, we're going to hear about an episode, an upcoming episode that will be broadcast in 2 weeks on July 12th. We won't give the ending away. But in this episode, you meet Jimmy Patterson from Stanton, Virginia, who shows you an artifact left to you, left to him by his father, who worked for an aircraft plant in Connecticut during World War II.
I've got a piece of fabric hand signed by Charles Lindbergh and Igor Sikorsky, dated August 1943, that my dad showed me when I was an early teenager. I have a suspicion that this fabric could have come out of the spirit of St. Louis.
Charles Lindbergh is famous for being the first person to make a nonstop flight from New York to Paris in 1927, and his single-engine plane was named the Spirit of St. Louis. So why is it unlikely that fabric signed in 1945 came from that plane?
Why is it unlikely?
Yeah.
Well, part of it is just when it came out. So this is a piece of fabric which is coming out in the 40s, or it's, you know, this guy is supposed to have received it in the 40s, and it was signed not only by Lindbergh, but by Igor Sikorsky. And of course, Igor Sikorsky is, you know, the maker of the first helicopter, or at least the first major helicopter. And he is also kind of a good friend and runs in the same circles as Lindbergh. But this is all happening in the 40s. Well, the Spirit of St. Louis was retired by then and was not being cut off of for these kinds of purposes, and at any rate, it had been recovered. That is, the outer layer had been replaced. So this was not a very likely kind of thing, but, you know, still it could have been possible. Who knows? Lindbergh, you know, theoretically could have kept a slip of the ship somewhere stuffed close and brought it out to sign for some deserving fan.
You know, it's always interesting to see the process of the investigation and how one clue kind of raises another question that leads you to another clue and so on. Does it really happen that way?
Well, the process of discovery definitely happens that way. And really what we're trying to do is to present to the audience the process of discovery. So if you have an object and it's similar to this object, if you watch the progression of the investigation that we're engaging in, it is the same process that you might use to uncover the provenance, the validity of the object that you have. So what we do with this piece of cloth is try to establish whether the signatures on it are authentic, whether the piece of cloth itself is something which would have come from an airplane, and if it would have come from an airplane, which airplane did it come from? How do we determine where that piece of cloth comes from? So what we show is that process of discovery that you would need to go through in order to come to a conclusion.
You know, I think Tukufu has hit the nail on the head here in terms of one of the reasons why the show is popular, and that is that we as history detectives show the viewer how research is done. You don't see that on a show like the Antiques Roadshow or any of the other shows that are now on various other cable programs. We actually show somebody how you do the research. And so in that sense, and I think Tukufu would agree with me, and our other fellow hosts, Elise LeRae, Eduardo Pagan, and Gwendolyn Wright would also echo this. Anybody can be a history detective if they have perseverance. Anybody can do this.
I am very personally proud of something that I discovered about an object I had. It turned out, I thought it was a newspaper from the Civil War. It turned out to be, and we could never find Marysville, Ohio, but it was actually from a division of the Ohio forces that went to fight in the Civil War, and it was their company newspaper.
Yeah, that was printed on a field press right in camp.
Right. And it took me a long time to figure it out, and then I brought it to the Ohio Historical Society, and they took up with it. But it is fun to do that. So any of our listeners out there, if you want any tips about how to do that, give us a call, 614-292-8513. What types of investigations do you find are the most personally meaningful, to Khufu or West? Does it matter if it's someone like Charles Lindbergh involved or not?
I find the most fulfilling investigations to be those where the object means something to the people that have presented it, because they're not only interested in the object, they're interested in the story, and it means something to them. And when you bring something like that, it has, you don't know what the consequences are going to be when you bring them the answer to their question. There was a young man who inherited a cane from his grandparents, and both of his grandparents and his parents were interned during World War II, because, you know, the Japanese were interned in the United States in these camps. And so his grandparents and his parents were there, but they left him a cane. And the story that we unfold about this cane was something he never thought about, even to the fact of who the cane owned, who owned the cane.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we brought him the information, he was totally overwhelmed with what we were able to go out and find. And, you know, and sometimes it's not that they have that personal connection, but they have a connection to the moment of discovery themselves of the object, which is another, I had another stick story this year, which was about a possible Teddy Roosevelt war club. And the way the couple found the club was in, and you know, they were renovating a building, and they found this club in there. And it said, you know, it had something written on there about Teddy Roosevelt. So that gave them a bonding with that particular experience. And they engaged in like a 20-year process of trying to find out, you know, about this club. So when we did our research and brought the information back to them, again, they had a personal connection to their moment of discovery of that club, and the information we gave them helped amplify the meaning of the story and the value that that club had to them. And those are the stories I find very fulfilling. How about you, Wes?
Well, I tend to agree with Takufu's assessment. I love these stories that that relate not to the big people in American history, but maybe the big story in American history, but they're very personal family stories. I think we've talked about this before in the last time I was on the show, that one of the appealing things about history detectives is that everybody in the United States has some family story, or nearly everybody does. Everybody's got something that's handed down to them from a relative that carries with it some story about their family history. And I refer to these stories that we investigate as history with a little h, because these are the personal family stories that people really get into, as opposed to history with a big H, which is the kind of history that we get when we take our survey courses and in high school and college, that really paint American history with a really broad brush, and frankly is the kind of history that puts a lot of people to sleep.
Well, ironically, I learned so much about history when I watch your show.
Exactly.
I may forget the details of the little story, but I learn about that sweeping, the panorama of the history. I feel it more.
Well, I think that's exactly right, that it's these little personal stories that every family has that can be then connected to the bigger story. And it makes the family feel so much more connected to American history in general, in the broader sense.
Takufu, in this episode of the History Detectives, you meet David Fellman of Minneapolis. He showed you a eulogy his father wrote from another veteran of the Spanish Civil War, an African-American veteran named Douglas Roach. And here David reads from the eulogy. I think it's a good example of what we've just been talking about.
Remember, Doug, the night we stood in a cold drizzle soaked to the skin, surrounded by our dead and dying comrades, our rifles clenched in our numb hands, waiting for the counterattack, and said over and over again, we'll pay them back. Doug, I promise you, we will pay them back.
That was a very emotional story for me, because it was so personal.
That was a very emotional story for me as well. And it aired, as you know, on Tuesday. And I have received a number of communications, not only from just generally out there, from fans who I love of the History Detectives, but also from family members, David himself and others, about how they really appreciated that story. That story was a very emotional story because it was about a forgotten moment in history. People don't talk that much about the the fight against fascism in Spain, and they don't talk about that much about the American citizens who risked their own citizenship to go and fight for democracy in that particular battle. But the most touching moment of that particular episode is when I get to dust off the gravesite of Douglas, and then to introduce these two individuals who have been named for their uncle.
Right.
And to bring them back together, and both of them thought of their uncles as these heroes, and to have them come together at that moment was also a very emotionally revealing moment for them and me as well.
You know, I watched this last night. I was out with friends on Tuesday and missed the original airing, but I watched it last night. And you know, not only was it emotionally wrenching, but also I think, as Takufu said, it taught me something about the Spanish Civil War that I really didn't know very much about at all, and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which I knew practically nothing about.
Yeah, tell us about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, Takufu.
So the United States and all of the other Western powers decided that they were not going to intervene, or they were not going to support the democratically elected government in Spain, and that they were going to allow the kind of, the military coup which happened and was receiving support from the fascists, from Germany and Italy, from Mussolini in Germany and from Hitler, from Mussolini in Italy and from Hitler in Germany. And so they were being attacked. Now, the United States had decided not to intervene, and so did all the other Western powers. But the Soviet Union decided that it was going to intervene, and it began to put out a call to individuals of like mind to come and intervene. And it organized these international brigades around the world to take individuals coming from, various countries, from Britain, from France, and from the United States. Those who came from the United States, they joined a particular brigade, and that was the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. So, somewhere less than 3,000 Americans went to fight, and in that number, somewhere around 100 or less of African Americans went to fight as well. And they all went to fight against fascism because they understood what it meant, and they had seen too many cases when the world did not rise up, because the world failed to rise up in terms of the response of the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. And so many thought this was a chance to redress that wrong. We can't let the fascists just have their way.
Paul in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Honored guests. Very interesting program. I was given I had two items, and your screener said that you decided on the one. I can talk to you later about the other, but anyway, Yeah, you get the idea.
You only get one. So.
I know. That's fine. My grandfather, Hugh Stewart Finlayson, resided for most of his life, not all of his life, but most of his life in Akron, Ohio. And he was at one time, I am told, the president of the Burns Club. He's a Scotsman of the first water. And I have in my possession a gavel that was carved from ostensibly a beam from, I believe, well, we would call it Edinburgh, but I believe the Scotch pronounce it Edinburgh Castle, was remodeled. You know, there was some alteration done to the structure in the late 1800s or very early 1900s, and there were a couple of beams left over that were turned over to carvers. And as I'm not sure, you know, the exact how he got it, except that he ordered it, a gavel. And when we say gavel, we think, you know, U.S. judges, like a hammer kind of thing. Well, that's not necessarily the way gavels actually look around the world. Some of them have a rounded head. This would be the rounded head kind of thing. And it is ostensibly carved from a beam of Edinburgh Castle circa 1907, 1910, somewhere around there. And I have actually the original receipt, $7.50.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting thing. It's quite intact. I mean, I'm partially a Scotsman, obviously, but it's an interesting thing. And if there's any commentary, the only thing I would add was that my grandfather was a 32nd degree Mason in a cavalry unit. Now, I've got a picture of him in his kilt and his fez,
mm-hmm.
but nothing associated with horsemanship. I just wonder if your guests would have any commentary as to whether this would be maybe a parade kind of, you know, a thing.
Are you talking about the gavel now?
No, I'm talking just about my grandfather in general.
Okay.
But, you know, the Scottish Rite Masons, what have you, horsemanship not being, you know, something you immediately would associate with that kind of thing. But the gavel, any information, I'll stay on the line.
Okay. Do you hear about things like that are carved from something else very often?
Well, in my business, we have a name for those, and those are historical relics. And the tradition of making things from objects that have some historical significance is a very long one. Over the years, I have sold many of these sorts of things. The USS Constitution comes to mind immediately. The Constitution has undergone several different episodes of major overhauling, and every time that the Constitution is overhauled, the wood or the iron nails or the plating on her hull is turned into something else. The Grand Rapids, there was a furniture company in Grand Rapids, Michigan, for example, in the 1920s or 30s that made a series of desks from the wood from the USS Constitution and actually put a plaque on them. And I've had the opportunity, I think, to sell those desks three different times over the past 16 years. So this is a long-standing tradition of peddling holy relics made from important things that are emblematic of events and people and places in American history.
I guess kind of like that piece of cloth from the Spirit of St. Louis. Same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is taking the piece of cloth and using it as a historical relic. I mean, here it's just cut out, so it hasn't been converted into a gavel or anything like that. Although it's something that it would be framed and placed on a wall.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Tekufu Zuberi and Wes Cowan of the History Detectives. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi. Hi, we're Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. We understand that you have a special relationship with your car.
When I first sat in the Buick and my tush hit the seat, it went, oh, yeah.
Of course, not everyone finds that special somebody.
8 cars in 15.
Yeah, but I buy a lot of junkers. This was my real...
Oh, if they're not junkers when you start, they become junkers pretty fast.
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk comes your way starting at 12 noon tomorrow and every Saturday here at 89.7 NPR News. Coming up at 11 o'clock on All Sides Weekend, your host will be Christopher Purdy, and today he'll talk about the arts in Central Ohio, including the Columbus Symphony, the Ketco Theater, and also some barbershop harmonies. That's coming up at 11 in about 20 minutes right here. In the weather forecast, a high today of 84 degrees with sunny skies, mostly clear tonight, and a low 61. Tomorrow, a slight chance of showers, a better chance a Saturday night and Sunday. In fact, Sunday, 70% chance of precipitation. Then on Monday, we'll have mostly cloudy skies and a high near 80 degrees. Right now, 71 degrees at our studios here on the OSU campus.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime, anywhere by streaming on the web. Just go to WOSU.org.
My guests are Takuvu Zuberi and Wes Cowan of The History Detectives, which has started a new season. If you want to learn more about that, go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link for you there. Nancy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just had to tell the person that took my call, when you mentioned the Grand Rapids desk, I happened to be sitting at a desk that was made by Grand Rapids, and I know that my grandparents acquired it probably in the early 20s. I can't be certain. So how would I find out if it's such a desk as you just mentioned?
That particular desk has a plaque on the inside drawer that says, this desk made from wood from old Ironsides. So it would actually be identified as having been made from wood from old Ironsides.
And is Grand Rapids a company that, I mean, if the desk
it's a city.
Well,
it also
was a furniture manufacturer, the Grand Rapids Furniture Company. But in general, Grand Rapids was a center for furniture manufacturing in the first quarter of the 20th century. Lots of companies were set up there making furniture in factories there. The Grand Rapids Furniture Company was only one of a number of companies that were there.
Right, Steelcase is still there. There's others still, but they're big. The big kind of there's a tradition still. It's
right.
My hometown. So. So Nancy, check it out. Did you?
I don't see any black yet, but I'm not going to take it all apart.
All right,
it'll be very visible right in the center drawer of the desk.
Okay. Well, I think it's pretty regardless. It's I think they called it a woman's writing desk instead of a spinet desk.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But my other question is, I've been lugging around a coat that my grandparents said was from the War of 1812, and just by accident, I almost pitched it. I found a piece of paper, a land grant signed by James Monroe. And apparently this ancestor from Morrow County served in the War of 1812, and, of course, they paid soldiers with land. How can I authenticate whether the signature on the land grant is James Monroe's or whether one of his secretaries signed it?
Well, the first thing you should know is that I would just almost bet that it is James Monroe's signature. Secretaries typically did not sign land grants until after the administration of Andrew Jackson. After Jackson's administration, the presidents never signed their land grant. I won't say never, but very, very seldom did they sign an individual land grant. Their secretaries did it. But from the period of Thomas Jefferson up through Jackson, virtually every land grant was signed by the sitting president. So you've got, I would almost bet dollars to donuts, a genuine James Monroe land grant. There were thousands of them issued, and virtually every family in Ohio that got one still has it because they kept this as a memento, a token of not only their ancestors' service during the War of 1812 or earlier, sometimes the Revolutionary War, but also it's proof that they own their property.
Nancy, thank you for that call. Joe in Columbus, you have a question?
Yes, I was wondering about Yakima's name, whether it's Canute or Canute. I always call him Canute. He was a major actor. He was not just a stuntman. He was a major actor in many of John Wayne's movies. An Indian, an entrepreneur, a sideman. He was a major actor.
Well, that's right. I thought that I had pointed out that he wasn't a leading star, but he was filling in for the star, and so from that standpoint, he certainly was an actor. But from everybody that I talked to during the investigation, it's Yakima Canute.
Okay. Thank you, Joe, from Columbus. Wes, in this episode, you meet the wife of a man who served in the Navy in World War II. She discovered what she thinks might be the original piece of propaganda, of a propaganda leaflet created by a woman artist and dropped by American forces on Japan during the war. You started your investigation by talking to 94-year-old Professor Paul Baller, who was a Japanese translator in World War II. Let's listen.
I've never seen one quite like it. It's what we call Nihongo, Japanese. And there are five illustrations here, and they all center on the same theme, that the Japanese military, or Gumbatsu, has taken over control of the government in an illegal way, usurping the power of the emperor and thrusting the country into an unnecessary war.
First of all, isn't it wonderful to find primary sources like that still?
Oh, please. This is like, again, and to Khufu, jump right in here. This is one of the great things for me personally about History Detectives is that I get to meet these amazing people who know so much more about the subject than I do, and I get to learn from them. And this was a great example.
Takufu?
You know, the beauty of what we do is we get these two extremes. One, we get to people invite us in their home, and they share their lives with us. And on the other hand, we get to talk to the experts on so many issues. And in the midst of these experts, we're usually surrounded by this wealth of history, which allows us to connect these objects often to, you know, what Wes calls the, we can connect the little H to the big H and sometimes the big H to the little H. And so this is a wonderful thing because when the story on Lindbergh's signature took me to the offices of one gentleman who had many Lindbergh signatures and a whole bunch of other signatures and a whole bunch of other historical artifacts.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I was like a kid in a candy store. Just everywhere I turned, there was a goodie that I wanted to touch.
That was the fellow with the wall of documents, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was great. You know, do you feel either of you I was wondering how you prioritize what you're going to go after next and if there's any impetus to go after things like World War II stories, World War II objects, and learn more about them because this population of people, there's still people out there like Professor Baller, but the population's shrinking.
Well, you know, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, please, please.
So, you know, this season I've covered stories that range from a map of the first map of Florida all the way up to, you know, past World War II. And that included, you know, the story on the Spanish Civil War, a story on Teddy Roosevelt, a story on the invention of popular exercise routines in the 20s and the 30s. And so we cover a wide range of stories. Definitely we have a number of stories which deal with World War II and the Civil War, because these are very popular issues in the country. But, you know, actually we cover stories that range the gambit of our history. And in fact, you know, one story I had a couple of seasons ago had to do with the history of hip hop.
I can only echo that. But I think that your point is well taken, Anne, that a lot of these stories, but I think they're accidental, deal with World War II in particular, because it really is, we get a lot of submissions about World War II. There are so many people whose lives were touched in one way or another by World War II, and this includes more and more the descendants of people who were whose parents or grandparents participated in that conflict, and they have these things that they want to know about. We all know through books like The Greatest Generation that World War II vets didn't typically talk about their service, and so after they're gone, daughter or whatever finds a box in the garage and says, gosh, what's this? Dad never talked about that. And that's where we come in.
Right. That was a box that propaganda leaflet was left in a box of a fellow. He died and his wife and his sister found it.
That's exactly right.
And hadn't been open for 60 years, they said.
And he'd never talked about it. And that led us to that great story.
You know, there was a great story within that story, which is, again, very, very typical. There's the stories within the stories. Professor Baller tells a story about after the war when he was in occupied Japan. He met the mayor of a city near Tokyo and found out that the leaflets did save civilian lives.
Yeah, reached that mayor's hands, and the mayor ordered the evacuation of the city that Baller had dropped these leaflets on, or Baller's office had dropped these leaflets on. Just amazing.
Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello, Gail.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about a compact that I was given. It's supposedly made out of tortoise shell, and I know it's tortoise shell is considered an endangered species, but I want to know how to tell if this is real tortoise shell or if it's fake, because I've been on eBay and a lot of people say that it's some kind of celluloid or plastic or whatever. But this particular, it's a ladies' compact with a mirror, but to me it looks very old, and it's roughly made. It doesn't look like it was made at Tiffany's or anything. And it's put together with little, small, tiny silver pins, and from what I've read on the Internet, that if you heat up, pins or metal, that it'll go right through tortoise shell. So I'm just wondering, how to tell if this is genuine or not.
Wes Takufu, where would you go? How would you start?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, boy, it sounds intriguing. Love to see a picture of it. If you wanted to send a picture to our company, we can be happy to look at that. And I don't know if it's okay to say the give them that email address or not.
Sure.
info@cowans.com, cowans.com. We can look at it and give you an answer. You're talking about an object, though, of not apparel, but something that a lady would carry around in her purse that didn't really begin to become popular until the 20th century, first quarter of the 20th century. My guess is that what you have is, if it is a truly a genuine factory-made compact, it does not have real tortoise shell in it. If, on the other hand, it's not really a compact, but it's something else that I can't really tell because I can't see it, from the 19th century, then it could very well be tortoise shell. Sailors used tortoise shell on whaling voyages and long-distance trips to make objects of beauty. If it's really sort of a crude thing, maybe it is some sailor-made thing, and it might be genuine tortoise shell. It's tough to tell without prying a little piece of that tortoise shell off and comparing it with a piece of celluloid, unless you've handled a lot of tortoise shell. And we'd be able to look at it for you and instantly give you an answer.
Thank you, Gail, for that question. And Marcia in Blacklick, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have my sister just recently found a Red Cross flag that apparently my dad brought home from World War II. He was a Navy doctor assigned to the Marines, and he established the first medical station on Iwo Jima that was not destroyed. And that's all we knew. He did not talk about it. So I was just wondering if there was any way for us to find out if this flag was the flag that he flew over his medical station on Iwo Jima.
Wow, great story. Takufu, what do you think?
excuse me. Wait, why don't you go ahead and take a...
Folks, Takufu has a bad case of bronchitis, and he told me this before we started. But, you know, that's a fascinating story, and it is a it's a typical history detective story. Was this flag one that was flown over a medical station on Iwo Jima? It also strikes me as a story that would be very difficult to prove because a Red Cross flag is a Red Cross flag is a Red Cross flag. Unless there's something that is written on the flag or goes with the flag itself, it would be very difficult, I think, to prove that this was the flag that was flown over that first station on Iwo Jima. The chances are that it might have been, but Red Cross flags are so generic that it might be very difficult to prove anything other than that it's a genuine World War II era Red Cross flag.
Thanks, Marcia, for that call. I want to thank my guest today, Wes Cowan of Cowan's Auctions, founder and owner of Cowan's Auctions in Cincinnati. Thanks for joining us today, Wes.
My pleasure. Always great to talk to folks here in Ohio.
And Takufu Zuberi. Takufu, are you there?
I am here.
Are you hanging in?
I'm back.
Especially, thank you for joining us, even though you're not feeling well today. I wouldn't have known it. So, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Takufu Zuberi and Wes Cowan of the History Detectives. They have started a new season, and you can see it at Tuesday evenings at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV, and get more information about that at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.